America is changing, and so is the world.
But what's happening in America isn't just the cause of global upheaval. It's also a symptom of disruption that's happening everywhere.
I'm Asma Khalid in Washington, D.C.
I'm Tristan Redman in London, and this is The Global Story.
Every weekday, we'll bring you a story from this intersection, where the world and America meet.
Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
WBEZ is supported by Impact Grants Chicago. Over 400 women come together in a unique model of collective giving. Each member contributes $1,000, and together those donations grow into $100,000 grants for Chicago nonprofits that address critical challenges across the city. By pooling resources, individual gifts multiply into greater impact. Listeners can learn more about Impact Grants Chicago and past grant recipients at impactgrantschicago.org/join2025.
There are certain groups of people that don't take vaccines and don't take any pills that have no autism.
Vaccines simply do not cause autism.
A CDC advisory panel voting to abandon its recommendation that all Americans receive the COVID-19 vaccine.
Illinois Department of Public Health issuing new guidance, their own guidance, expanding COVID-19 vaccine access.
Hey, Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Today on the show, the Illinois Department of Health yesterday dropped its own COVID-19 vaccine guidance, breaking away from the CDC recommendations. We lay out what it says and what it means for Illinoisans. And don't forget to stick around after that for a breakdown of the latest local news in and around Chicago. First, though, senior producer Sienna Greaves is here with me. She produced this segment. Hey, Sienna.
How you doing, Sasha?
Good to see you. Now, a lot of back and forth this month between the federal government and the state governments and medical associations. I'm getting a little whiplash.
Yes, a lot of mixed messaging from the top that's created a lot of confusion around the best ways to access vaccines and stay safe during the upcoming respiratory illness season.
Oh, yes, that's right. It's that time of year again.
It is that time of year again. And the FDA guidance really narrowed eligibility for the vaccine to those over 65 years old and people at high risk for developing severe illness from the virus. Then a few weeks later, the CDC advised that adults 65 and older and younger people can get the shot if they want, with the caveat that they consult with their doctor first. And then as of yesterday, the Illinois Department of Health, as you mentioned, dropped its own guidelines, which pretty much maintains access eligibility for all adults and children.
And, you know, when we talk about high risk, Sienna, what stands out to me is how one guest really seemed to remind us that, especially after what we've seen since the pandemic days, you know, from COVID and beyond, Black and brown communities are also high risk. And we should be thinking about them when we have these discussions, because they're typically the hardest hit and, you know, lack the resources to get proper medical help. So when it comes to, you know, the federal government limiting access to vaccines,
on top of federal cuts to these programs,
that is going to impact Black and brown communities greatly.
Yeah, absolutely, Sasha.
All right, lots to chat about there. Thank you, Sienna.
Thank you, Sasha.
At the table, Dr. Kiran Joshi, Chief Operating Officer for Cook County Department of Public Health. Dr. Ravi Javeri, Division Head of Pediatric Infectious Diseases at Lurie Children's Hospital of Chicago. And Creola Hampton, Founding Board President of the Black Leadership Advocacy Coalition for Healthcare Equity. Dr. Javeri, let's start with the very latest. As I said, new COVID-19 vaccine recommendations have come down from IDPH. What are they?
Yeah, I guess maybe I would start by reframing what you said, which is that the state and our health officials have really maintained access to COVID-19 vaccines. This is maintaining the recommendations for broad sort of guidance for who can receive and should receive the vaccine. And so I commend them certainly for being proactive when it looked like issues may be in jeopardy, thinking about it. So the long and the short is that the vaccine is still recommended for all adults 18 and over. It's recommended for all pregnant women. It's recommended for all young children 6 months to 23 months. And effectively, it's recommended for all children There is a specific sort of firm recommendation for children that have a broad array of medical conditions that may put them at a high risk for complications from COVID.
Right.
But there's also a line that basically says if any parent wants to have their child vaccinated, they can and it should be covered under the same standing order that Secretary Vora had put in place.
Yeah. And to your point there, it is still recommended, like I said, for all adults, all children from 6 months to 23 months, but in that age 2 through 17, they sort of have some stipulations of risk categories that the child should fall under. Tell us how much these guidelines deviate from the guidelines that we've recently seen from federal authorities, Dr. Joshi.
Thanks, Sasha. So previously, CDC was recommending essentially universal vaccination for everyone over 6 months of age, and it was sort of an opt-out approach. The recent shift was more towards an opt-in approach, and I think as someone who sits on the state's Immunization Advisory Committee, some of the thinking, and by the way, I do want to add that this is a body made up of just incredibly sharp, committed physicians, pharmacists, and other public health professionals from across the state. Mm-hmm. And so the conversation, the decision-making was very deliberative and very thoughtful and really took into account the idea that this shift to shared decision-making really would weaken the clarity of a universal message of vaccination and would really put more burden on clinicians and patients, essentially depressing or reducing vaccine uptake, with particular attention to those who may have less access to healthcare services. So, right. Really potentially adding to those inequities that all of us in public health want to work to address.
Yeah. And when we talk about, you know, just even breaking down the fact that, okay, well, if your child is high risk, you know, then that child can get a vaccine. What do we mean by high risk, Dr. Javeri? What qualifies as high risk?
So that's kind of a fuzzy area, right? And so there are some clear indications for high risk. If you have existing lung disease, heart disease, neurologic disease, a condition that weakens your immune system, whether you're born with it or whether it's part of medications that you're getting or treatment that you're getting for a condition. And then you get into the other areas that are like sedentariness or inactivity, and what level of obesity might qualify, and how severe is your asthma. I think that there then becomes this discretion that, as others have mentioned, that it becomes sort of more of a complicating factor for physicians or pharmacists to try to discern, like, who makes that choice? Where do I draw the line in the mm-hmm. fuzziness? And I think that's the challenge. I would just parenthetically add that we know that for any vaccines where shared decision-making is the recommendation, that administration rates ultimately are low. Mm-hmm. And so just by making that change, we go from usually very high levels of vaccination to low to middling levels.
Interesting. As we talk about various folks trying to discern what's what and what's changed, there's so much mixed messaging, Criolla, coming from the top. I wonder how that impacts your work and the work of community health organizations on a whole.
Well, the first thing to note is, to your question of what is a high risk, what is high risk? And high risk a lot of times is defined just not on health activity, but on what? Race, age, and gender. And mm-hmm. when we look at the statistics that come out from CDC and every place else, all the statistics for disease are based on race, age, and gender. And when we talk about community-based organizations, especially for African-Americans, those African-Americans are at highest risk. What does that mean? It means we are, in the state of Illinois, only 14% of the population. Non-Hispanic African-Americans are only 14% of the population in Illinois. People think it's more. We're 29% of the population in the city, a little bit more in the county. Mm-hmm. But only 14% of the population are non-Hispanic African-Americans. Yet, for almost every disease category, especially and including COVID, we're 46, 47% of the incidence of infection.
That's a stark contrast.
And high rates of death. So who was the first person in the state of Illinois that was diagnosed with COVID, that died of COVID? It was a Black woman. Where? On the south side of Chicago. So who's high risk? Non-Hispanic African-Americans.
Talk more then about how limiting vaccine access can then specifically target that community.
And once again, what audience were those that had the lowest numbers of vaccines? Again, non-Hispanic African Americans. A lot of the funding is going to hospitals and clinics as we here to do vaccine promotion, mm-hmm. but African Americans are primarily going to the hospitals when there is an emergency. So there is very little. The trickle down has to go to Black-led community-based organizations because they are the ones that are in the trenches, indigenous to the population, have the highest degree of cultural competency. However, what is the problem? The biggest problem is they are the ones that get the lowest amount of funding from the state,
yeah,
from the government. You can't have budgets that are millions and millions of dollars for COVID tracing, for COVID promotion, for COVID promotion and education, and then only have 2% of funding going to Black-led organizations across the state collectively. So if the funding is not following the incidence in terms of prevention and awareness, then the vaccines themselves won't happen. And that has historically been the problem and still is.
Dr. Joshi and Dr. Javeri, you're both nodding as Criolla is laying out some really important facts here. I wonder what comes to mind. You first, Dr. Javeri.
I certainly agree with the points that were made. I think it speaks to the broader issues around how we provide care and particularly vaccines, and that I think we need to really expand on the model for sort of whether it's physician office administration or pharmacy-led administration. We were having a conversation about an experience years ago with school-based vaccination. And I think the idea is it may be schools, it may be community centers, it may be community-based events. I think the partnerships we're talking about, not relying on a physician or pharmacist model, we really have to think broadly about ways the vaccines are provided in many parts of the world so that it's really available effectively everywhere, and the funding and the infrastructure and the personnel and the training all comes together in a bundle so that the doors are open to anyone in the specific context of their community.
Dr. Joshi?
Yeah, absolutely. I found myself not only nodding but smiling because we had a really vigorous conversation about equity earlier. And I think that it's important to say that for local governments, for local public health, we really want to advance health equity. And one of the practical ways that we do that is by allocating resources according to need. So when we think about where our health department is focusing its activities in the vaccination space, we look very closely at vaccination uptake rates. And we have, for example, conducted 17 clinics just this past month in schools with some of the lowest vaccination uptake in suburban Cook County. And we're going to continue doing that work. Yeah. We established an immunization program at our health department a couple of years ago following the pandemic, really because we saw this year-over-year decline in immunization rates and were really concerned by what we were seeing. That is a multifaceted approach. It includes taking the vaccine to the people. It also includes a really strong sort of communications approach. So we do a lot of sort of myth busting on our social media, looking at really specific myths that we're seeing surfaced in the moment and trying to refute them on an ongoing basis. And then, of course, we also do more sort of traditional media,
right,
always focused on communities where we have the lowest vaccine uptake.
How unusual would you say this is, Dr. Javeri, for the state agencies to do this, to just kind of break away from federal guidelines? Have we seen this before?
I think that it's been a long time since we've seen anything like this. I think that in the past, and certainly in the entirety of my career, I can speak, we have had a process where the ACIP has a fairly robust and thorough process where they have a group of vetted experts in vaccine, public health, and also community representatives who are serve on the panel. But then information is collected and reviewed by advisory groups who are even more expert mm-hmm. in the specific areas, whether it's flu or COVID or hepatitis or other conditions.
Yeah.
And those the recommendations of the working group are then brought to the ACIP. The ACIP then discusses not only the medical potential medical effects of vaccine, but also issues of cost effectiveness, of who is included, issues of equity, distribution, availability, what untoward effects they might have with either a partial recommendation or full recommendation. And then the committee votes. And in the past, states and expert medical societies have lined up because that process was open, transparent, and solicited input at every step. We have seen with the last two meetings of ACIP that that process is nowhere to be found, that there is not an open comment period. There is not a clear expert consensus. The working groups have really been marginalized or disbanded. And so many of us are left with looking at an agenda that comes out for the meeting 2 to 3 days before. There's a new agenda that's introduced each day that's tweaked or adjusted, or even a new topic comes up. And so many of us in the space are left with wondering if these recommendations are coming out. It's not clear they're based on a rigorous evidence review, and there's no real process that we have been concerned for quite some time that something like this would happen. And so I would just say, to the point that Dr. Joshi made before, I was part of some discussions with some of the advisory groups that were mentioned, really just saying, hey, we are concerned that this is something that's going to happen. And those conversations happened many months ago. And so I think you're seeing the evolution of what was discussed to try to maintain access, use evidence-based guidance. And I think, you know, organizations like the American Academy of Pediatrics, based here in Illinois, have been issuing vaccine guidance for decades. And so their recommendations for universal administration of many of the vaccines we're talking about are really still in place. And so I think what you're seeing is this pivot. And I think what our state government and health leaders basically have aligned the state with the AAP recommendations to maintain the universal administration.
Of course, our reality is that COVID is not the only thing that we're grappling with, Dr. Joshi. We're heading into respiratory illness season. So beyond coronavirus, I mean, what other illnesses are going around?
That's exactly right. So influenza vaccination is recommended for all people 6 months of age and older. I want to remind your listeners that influenza, while common, can be fatal. Just last year in Illinois, we saw 12 pediatric flu deaths. I think many of these are preventable, and vaccination is an incredibly important strategy to prevent those tragic deaths. RSV immunization, I think, is also another important consideration. RSV is another kind of respiratory virus. The recommendations there are a little bit more focused on pregnant people, infants, and older adults. So if you're someone who is pregnant or could be pregnant, would definitely want you to talk to your healthcare provider about that. If you are a parent of a young infant, would also encourage you to have that conversation.
And the best way to protect ourselves is that conversation, but also vaccines.
Absolutely right. Yeah. So adults 50 through 74, some of whom are at increased risk, should have that conversation with their provider about RSV vaccination, and all adults 75 and up.
Yeah. And Criolla, we're almost out of time, but I think about all of the challenges that we're facing. You laid out so eloquently the way that community health organizations can work to sort of help communities and Black and Brown communities have the best access and spread the word, essentially. Tell us more about how you're making sure to continue doing that, because as we're seeing federal cuts come down, these are the communities that are reeling the most yes. impacted, right? And community health organizations are on the ground and yes. best capable to help.
Next week, the Illinois Legislative Black Caucus Foundation is having their policy summit. The largest caucus in the state of Illinois is the Black Caucus Foundation. We are pushing those legislators to pay attention to the funding to ensure that funding is more equitable from the Illinois Department of Public Health. But we're also doing the same thing on the city level when it comes to the Department of Health and Human Services, and really pushing not just for the mayor but the heads of those committees to look at how funding is allocated. I will say this, just 3 weeks ago, the head of the Syndemic Disease Bureau for the Chicago Department of Public Health was fired. A lot of he was fired under a lot of scrutiny about what inequity of allocation of resources to where the community organizations and to communities that are most impacted. The communication to African Americans, non-Hispanic African Americans, those who are at highest risk, has to be a focus. It cannot happen in the doctor's office and at the hospitals. It has to happen in the communities, and that means the community-based organizations must be the ones who are targeted and given the resources to do so.
As we wrap here, Dr. Javeri, just lots of information here this hour that we've shared at the table. What would you like to leave folks listening to us with? Just if you could leave them with one takeaway. There's been so much conflicting information, but what should they know right now?
I always like to go back to the fact that when we think about sort of the statistic that 90% of parents end up fully vaccinating their children, and we spend a lot of time talking about the small percentage who either hesitate or outright refuse vaccine. And studies also show that parents really trust, whether it's their pediatrician or primary care provider. They're the ones that have been with you when your child is sick, when you have to call at 2 a.m. with questions, concerns, because you're worried sick about your child. Mm-hmm. And so I think that you should not be looking for information on TikTok or from other non-medical people who are really not qualified. Talk to your doctor about these decisions and know that the recommendations are put in place was, with the thought and intent about the best interests of your child.
Yeah, we'll leave it there. Dr. Ravi Javeri is a division head of pediatric infectious diseases at Lurie Children's Hospital of Chicago. Dr. Kiran Joshi is a chief operating officer for Cook County Department of Public Health, and Creola Hampton is founding board president of the Black Leadership Advocacy Coalition for Healthcare Equity. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Now it's time to catch you up on the big stories of the day. We checked in with WBEZ news anchor Claire Lane and In the Loop executive producer Dan Tucker. And the conversation ran the gamut from Governor Pritzker asking state agencies to make 4% budget cuts to immigration enforcement to granny flats. Claire, kick things off.
So Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker loves to take lots of precautions. This we know about him, but he's essentially asking state agencies to set money aside for what he's calling a potential economic downturn. Mm-hmm. He issued an executive order, signed it yesterday, which is ordering agencies to put aside, this is up to 4% of their budgets, in a reserve sort of fund. And he's doing this because of what he's characterized as potentially disastrous effects on our state government from Trump's federal tax cuts and tariffs, various program cuts. Think about what happened to SNAP, right?
Yes.
So the executive order Pritzker signed, it's also calling on agencies to limit non-essential spending and some of their travel, also putting limits on new hires and outline potential program cuts if this shortfalls, starts to emerge.
Right.
For now, though, the reserves could spare legally required state payments for government pension systems, as well as K-12 education funding. So he's sort of covering a lot of bases.
Yeah, he's just saying, all are huge hurdles that the state essentially will have to grapple with, in the next year's budget. So he's trying to get ahead of that, Dan. I wonder what goes through your mind, though, when you see the governor saying, hey, agency heads, line up these cuts.
Yeah, honestly, the first thing that came to mind was just all of the different things that the Trump administration is cutting when it comes to state and local aid. And also, not to be too self-involved, but I immediately thought of the cuts to public media and how that will account for about 5% of budget here at Chicago Public Media. And if we think about 4%, 5%, we know that for us, it's going to be a hard decision down the line about where does that money come from? How are we funding the things that we do here? Mm-hmm. The same thing is going to be happening in the state agencies. I mean, these state agency heads are going to have hard decisions to make about how am I going to choose which 4% to cut.
Yeah.
You know, and I also think about the little guy, right? Like the little guy, the less fortunate among us, they do seem to be hit harder when these cuts
Absolutely.
Come down.
Absolutely.
I'm thinking back to, 2015 to 2017 when we had Governor Rauner in place and we didn't have a state budget for 2 years. And that affected a lot of social yeah. service agencies, other things. So, you know, when we talk about state agencies, I'm thinking about Department of Children and Family Services. Mm-hmm. Does that mean less people going door to door to check on kids to make sure they're okay? What about Veterans Affairs, public health? We have a lot going on with COVID vaccines right now.
And Claire said, you know, SNAP. Of course, I'm also thinking about, you know, the anticipated reductions in federal Medicaid, right?
Yeah.
That's going to impact so many people. We've talked about this.
I'm wondering also, you know, will we see furloughs? Will we see program cuts, service cuts? What is this going to mean when we say 4% cuts?
Mm-hmm. Well, what kind of response are we hearing from Illinois lawmakers, Dan?
Yeah, well, Democrats, as you might expect, are in lockstep with the governor. They have been very critical of the Trump administration. Republicans are actually very critical of Governor Pritzker and have used this as an opportunity to criticize him, mm-hmm. to say that, you know, hey, over the years, over the last few years you've been in charge, you've increased the size of the state budget. It's up to about $55 billion last year. The governor will say, well, hey, we need those things. These are important services for residents of the state. Here's one quote from John Curran from Downers Grove. He's the Senate Republican leader. And he says, if he, Governor Pritzker, is serious about protecting Illinois' fiscal solvency, he will start by making the difficult and sometimes unpopular decisions needed to constrain state spending, reduce taxes, and improve economic opportunity for all Illinoisans. Mm. So that's what he has to say.
Yeah, they say he's passing blame here. Let's talk accessory dwelling units because they're back in the news. People might know these by their much more entertaining nickname, Granny Flats. What's going on?
That's correct. And we should remind people that this is also budget related. But alderpersons have reached a compromise on what was long a stalled proposal to authorize Granny Flats citywide. And they want to use this money to chip away at Chicago's housing shortage.
Mm-hmm.
But the ordinance would allow Chicagoans to build coach houses. Many of us see these tiny homes, or even sort of converting some of their basements into rental properties without special permission from the city. And this is except in single-family home areas where alderpersons would have to opt in to allow for coach houses, giving them, the alder yeah. people in these wards, the final say. So that stipulation is actually a compromise to satisfy some of these alder people like Marty Quinn on the Southwest mm-hmm. side, who says allowing, you know, blanket approval for all coach houses all across the city. He has been very vocal. He said it would destroy the character of what many refer to as Chicago's bungalow belt.
Mm. Dan, what are you, team Granny Flats or what do you think?
I don't know where I fall on it personally, but one thing that this makes me think of when you mentioned the alderman having control here, you know, this idea of aldermanic prerogative in Chicago and that aldermen get to kind of call the shots about what happens in their wards. I wonder if we end up with a system here where some neighborhoods have the ability to have granny flats mm-hmm. and there's a lot of grannies living in the backyard. And then other neighborhoods do not. And so, you know, I even think of my own ward. I live in the 36th ward, which is a very strangely shaped gerrymandered ward
yes.
where we have a little bit of West Town. There's this long stretch along Grand Avenue and then parts of Belmont Cragen. I mean, so even in our own ward, I mean, I could imagine like someone living literally two blocks away from me, a block away from me, who has a different rule that they have to abide
right.
by when it comes to granny flats.
That is very interesting. Dan, let's get into the latest on immigration enforcement. That's been a huge topic for the last couple of weeks here on WBEZ. Give us the latest on this so-called Midway Blitz happening.
Yeah, and let me give kudos to our Sun-Times colleague Nader Issa, who has a great explainer in the newspaper and up online right now.
Yes.
That just goes into the details. And I'll just go through some of the key questions that he has pointed out. So one key question, how long is this going to go on?
Yes.
It's been going on since, you know, for a few weeks now in September. The short answer is we don't know because the Trump administration is not giving information about, you know, is this going to last another 2 weeks, another month? We really have no idea. Another key question is how many arrests have been made? And this one is, I won't use the word controversial, but it's in question because the Department of Homeland Security says there's been 550 arrests in Chicago in September, but we can't really verify that figure because ICE is not releasing the data in the same way that they might have under previous administrations. So we are trying to get more information about that as an organization here. How and where are these arrests happening?
Yeah.
I mean, it kind of started in public places. We saw that flower vendor on the southwest side was arrested. Then we started to see more traffic stops. We know the story of Silverio Villegas Gonzalez.
Tragic this story.
The 38-year-old man in Franklin Park, here without legal status. He was pulled over in a traffic stop, and he ended up being fatally shot by ICE. We still don't have all the details on that, but that's an example of a traffic stop arrest or an attempted arrest. Then, of course, workplaces, we're seeing people getting pulled out of Home Depot parking lots where maybe they had gone to seek manual labor. And even in people's homes, there was the raid in Elgin about a week ago where military fatigues. Christy Noem is there from Department of Homeland Security. They just knock on the door and bust in. So we're seeing all sorts of different types of arrests.
Yeah, shout out to Nader Issa on that great explainer piece in the Sun-Times today. Claire, Illinois Democrats in Congress, they've sent a letter to Homeland Security Chief Christy Noem about all of this. Quickly, what's their message?
Yeah, essentially, it's just don't come into our communities. And this was really prompted by when Noem, as Dan mentioned, was in Elgin. There was also a lot of ICE officials on the ground when she was there. She was promoting those enforcement operations. Mm-hmm. But what residents were telling WBEZ and the Sun-Times is that they were outraged. They were shocked at all these sort of military style tactics during those operations, those enforcements. Residents were saying they woke up to helicopters. This was just last week. Drones, crews of armed men. So senators are saying, don't come here. We don't want you here. And that they have a plan. And they're basically equipped residents to know their rights.
And that's been a consistent message, right, over the last several weeks coming from this state and from the city of Chicago. What other stories are you watching, Claire?
We're going to just lighten it up just a touch here.
Please do.
Northsiders know the Wiener Circle. It's a place on Sheffield where you can sort of get a hot dog, but also a little sass.
Oh, you've got hot dog news for us.
I do. I have dog news. But there were, blocks worth of people waiting to get a free hot dog yesterday. Wiener Circle promised they would give dogs to residents if Caleb Williams, Chicago Bears QB, threw four touchdown passes, which he did. So Chicago actually made good on that promise. And the owner of Wiener Circle expected to give out 3,000 complimentary sausages yesterday.
Awesome. Awesome. Another story I want to touch on while you're here. Dan, as many people are aware, Jimmy Kimmel is back on the air in the Chicago area. But some people, including Governor Pritzker, are asking this.
Question now is, Sinclair, Nexstar, why are they holding out? What is it exactly that is the reason that they won't put Jimmy Kimmel back on the air?
So if you've got family or friends downstate or in Northwest Illinois, they might not be seeing Kimmel. And that is because Sinclair and Nexstar, as the governor mentioned, they own a handful of ABC affiliates in Illinois that cover Rockford, Champaign, Quincy, and Springfield. Did you get a chance to catch it?
I did
last
not.
Night?
No.
I did not, but I've heard some of the highlights.
There's a lot of chatter in the newsroom about it this morning.
A lot of chatter in the newsroom. I heard some clips, some highlights, and heard the part where he got emotional, but it was a decent monologue
at
the top
like
of the show.
Yeah, sounds like he gave a pretty impassioned defense of free speech.
Yes, yes, as expected. Now, before I let you go, you're the executive producer, of course, of In the Loop, Dan. Why don't you, while you're here, give listeners just a tease of some of the things that they'll hear on the show in the next few days.
Yeah, so a couple topics we're looking into. We have covered in the past e-bikes and e-scooters. What are the rules around those?
That's
sometimes
right.
It can feel like e-bikes or e-scooters are, in the bike lane or on the road or on the bike path. And where are they supposed to be? How fast can they go?
Yeah.
There was an unfortunate story of a teen in Arlington Heights last week who was riding on an e-scooter in the evening, in the dark, wasn't following traffic rules and was hit by a truck and fatally struck. There's a lot of questions coming from suburbs and the city as to will the state come in and create rules that, are uniform across the state.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to look more into that.
Yeah.
And then another thing is grocery prices. We've covered grocery prices going up. They seem to keep going up.
Yes.
I know that Stephanie Zimmerman over at the Sun-Times is tracking prices
is
of individual items.
Great.
So
great.
I think we need to get her back on.
We
got to
follow up on both of those stories for sure.
This episode of In the Loop was produced by me, Sienna Greaves, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. If you like what you just heard, we hope you'll join us for more. We drop a new episode about Chicago news and culture every weekday afternoon, including our weekly news recap on Fridays. And once a month, Ask the Mayor. Thanks for listening and have a great day.